trust. And I presume you trust Mrs. Ballantyne?
She doesn't answer.
Do I seem like myself, Alice?
I ask. She shakes her head.
Because I'm not. Or because you're pretending you're not. You tricked the master, and now you've tricked the mistress. Mrs. Ballantyne is a good woman, and she wants to help. And you're giving her what she wants. That's what Mrs. Wallace says.
Mrs. Wallace is smart, I say. Yes, it makes more sense to give someone what they want and lower their defenses.
You admit it, then?
I admit it would be a good strategy. But why not employ it sooner? I have a feeling I was always nice to Mrs. Ballantyne, am I right?
You tricked her! Right from the start, tricked her and then lorded it over us.
I lean back, arms braced on the bed. Well, then I'm not sure how to prove I've really changed now. I do seem changed, don't I? I don't remember much of my past, and that makes me a different person. Very different.
Too different, she says. You seem altogether another person. And Mrs. Wallace doesn't like it, so I don't either. Either you are lying, or you are possessed.
Possessed? I stifle a laugh, half at the idea and half at how, in its way, this is far more accurate than Alice could imagine. Have you ever heard of a possessed person being better than they were before?
Perhaps you are a changeling, then. That is a fairy child put in the bed of a human one.
Oh, I know all about the fair folk. My nan told me stories. If I were a changeling, I'd be the human returned, wouldn't I? The fairy stole me as a baby and replaced me with a wicked fairy child. But now I have come home and banished her. She considers this and then looks at me.
Is that what happened?
She asks, in all seriousness. And I bite back a smile by reminding myself just how deep the belief in fairies runs here, in this land, at this time.
I have no idea what happened, I say, only that I am not the person I was. And this one seems better, so I will keep being her for as long as I am able.
And if I turn back into my old self, I have warned Mrs. Ballantyne to send me away.
Did she agree?
She did, and so you've nothing to fear from me. If I do hurt you, then it is the old me, and you should tell Mrs. Ballantyne straight away. Understood? She nods, wary gaze on me.
Now,
I say, I presume you were looking for proof that my personality change is a trick. I'm not sure what you hope to find. A journal of my confessions, perhaps. You are free to continue your search. So far, I have found a pouch of money, sweets sent to Mrs. Ballantyne by a hopeful suitor, and this letter. You may search away. She continues, eyeing me. I mean it, I say as I back onto the bed and pick up a book. Search to your heart's content. You may find more evidence that the old Katrina was a scoundrel and a thief, but none that I am telling lies now. She watches me for another moment, and then she begins to search. Chapter 26. I am pleased to say that Alice finds nothing. Not pleased because I feared she might, but pleased to have my searching skills pass the test. It's obvious that Alice has hidden a thing or two in her life, and she spends well over an hour going through my room. She misses the loose floorboard. While she checks the floor, she fails to see the telltale signs, and I show her afterward. Having no plans to turn thief, I'm not the least bit concerned that she knows about Katrina's best hiding spot. Also, I've been drinking, so my judgment may not be at its best. At least I'm not drunk enough to tell her the truth about myself. She leaves satisfied that I'm not an imminent threat to her family in service, and I head to bed. That doesn't mean I get much sleep. Even if the Raven Killer hasn't realized I'm not really Katrina, he still targeted me. He knows I'm Gray's housemaid. He could come to finish the job. And if he's from the 21st century and thinks I know who he is, too, he'll definitely try taking me out. I can't stop thinking about Isla saying Mrs. Wallace only locks the doors at night. Does she ever forget? No one's likely to know if she did, or if she decided to leave it open for Gray. I last saw Gray at dinner, and I have no idea whether he's still out. The point is that whoever attacked me may try to finish the job, and I'm not exactly sleeping in a house with double deadbolts and a security system. I put the switchblade under my pillow. That's part of what keeps me awake. The rest is this puzzle. Is it possible that the Raven Killer is the serial killer who tried to strangle me in 2019 Edinburgh? I itch to grab my phone and start jotting down notes, working through the case for and against that conclusion. I should have taken extra paper from Gray's office, but I hadn't wanted to push my luck. I think of the library downstairs, where there must be paper and pens. But I barely avoided being sacked today. I can't afford to be caught skulking about at night. Let's start with potential arguments against my theory. The most obvious is the one I considered earlier. How would he survive in this world? Figure out whose body he inhabits? How would he blend in? It's not impossible. I managed it. I'm still weathering the bumps, but I am managing. Therefore, he could do the same, especially with the twin advantages of being in a male body and being from Edinburgh. I struggle to find solid arguments against the killer being from the modern world, so I switch to the other side temporarily, signs he could be the 21st century killer. First, the rope. It had caught my attention the moment Gray lifted it from Evans's body. Something inside me jumped in recognition. I'd easily explained it away, but it still remains a piece of evidence in favor of my theory. Both that killer and this one like to strangle with rope. The trap is the next obvious factor in favor of my theory. I'd been lured into a dark alley following sounds of a woman in danger. Might not Katrina then be pulled in by the even stronger lure of a child in distress? Then there's the moment during our fight when he seemed to recognize me. Recognize the real me as the victim who'd fought back in the modern world. I'd been fighting for my life and not caring whether I was talking or acting like a Victorian housemaid. That modern talk caught his ear, as the modern self-defense techniques caught his attention. A moment of déjà vu for both of us. Is that enough? My defense attorney mother would say no. It's not enough to convict him of the crime of being my modern-day attacker. However, it would be enough evidence for the Crown prosecutor to sign off on questioning him. Enough to charge him while I gathered more for trial? Possibly. But that doesn't matter here. Here, my question is only whether it's enough for me to pursue this theory. It is. Is there anything in Evans's murder that suggests his killer wasn't from my time? Fingerprints or other obvious forensic evidence could hint at a Victorian murderer. It's too late to test that with Evans, but I do recall my attacker last night wore gloves, plus the hood that might keep him from shedding hairs. Still, that was also part of his disguise, so I can't read too much into it. There's nothing in the staging or the method of murder that indicates either a modern or Victorian killer. I'll have to go through that more carefully once I have paper and pen, but a mental rundown pings nothing. What about the torture? Nope. The old splints under fingernails dates back at least to the 13th century, from the book Gray lent me. And I investigated a case 6 months ago where it had been used. Nothing there, so I bolt up in bed. The water Gray found in Evans's lungs, combined with the lung damage and restraints, suggests waterboarding. I've seen that, too, and cops I know say it mostly started after the news of waterboarding at Guantanamo Bay. It's a bloodless and effective torture method. One MacCready laughed at. Pouring water on someone's face? How was that torture? Anyone who has ever been yanked underwater knows how horrible it is. Even if your brain realizes you aren't going to drown, your body reacts with primal panic. Gray hadn't rolled his eyes quite as hard as MacCready, but he'd dismissed it too. Does that mean waterboarding is a modern method of torture? Almost certainly not. If there's a way to terrify another human being, someone found it millennia ago. Yet Gray and MacCready's disbelief, combined with everyone who web-searched waterboarding after the Guantanamo Bay incident, tells me it's not like forcing splints into nail beds. Not something they'd have read in a book or a news article. But if you're a modern killer looking for bloodless torture, waterboarding would rank at the top of your list. If this is the same killer, then there's something else I need to think about. Something I've forgotten, being so caught up in the possibility that I've brought a modern killer into Victorian Scotland. I jumped into the body of Katrina as she was being strangled by her would-be killer. So, logically, where would my would-be killer have ended up? In the body of Katrina's killer. Find him, whoever he is, and I'll have the Raven Killer. The next morning starts as expected. Alice has been charged with taking Gray's breakfast to him, meaning I remain in that particular doghouse. Then he's off to work before I need to clean his quarters. Isla leaves before breakfast for some engagement or other. I'm cleaning Gray's bedroom, my mind working through the implications of my theory, when his unmistakable footsteps pound up the stairs. He's in a hurry, and I glance around, feeling the odd impulse to hide, as if I'm about to be caught somewhere I'm not supposed to be. I continue dusting, presuming he'll run in, grab what he wants, and run out again. Instead, he stops in the doorway.
"You," he says.
"Yes, I am dusting your room, sir. I was not told I shouldn't."
"I have been looking everywhere for you. Come."
He waves and strides off. I hesitate, barely a heartbeat, but it's enough to have him shouting back,
"Katrina!"
"Coming, sir."
He continues down two flights of stairs, and I think we're going to the funeral parlor, but he throws open the back door instead. I rack my brain to think of what I might have forgotten to do outside. But that is the domain of Simon and the part-time gardener, Mr. Tull. When a coach emerges from the stable, Gray grunts and waves me toward it.
"Sir," I say, "if I'm going out, I need to change my boots and put on a coat."
His look clearly conveys, not this again, irritation. As much as I don't want to wear my indoor boots through the muck again, I'm really balking because the chill creeping down my spine has nothing to do with the weather. Isla is gone, and Gray is suddenly very anxious to bundle me off on a coach ride. Has he realized that, with his sister away, he can fire me and tell her I quit?
"In the carriage, Katrina," he says. "Now, we haven't much time."
Not much time before Isla returns? I want to insist on getting a coat in hopes of stalling, but Gray is holding the coach door, and his expression warns that a 2-minute delay will only annoy him more. I climb in. Gray rattles off an address to Simon, and we're gone. As we move from Prince's Street into the narrower lanes of the old town, I glance anxiously at Gray.
"May I ask where you are taking me, sir?"
He doesn't answer. Doesn't even seem to hear. He's gazing outside, frowning. Then he calls to Simon, telling him where to let us out.
"Dr. Gray?"
I say. He turns sharply to me.
"Describe the man who attacked you. Please."
"What?"
I stammer.
His brows knit with impatience.
The attack the other night. Or do you think it could have been the same person who attacked you the first time?
I hesitate. Yes, it's the same attacker, in a way. But I've already said that I didn't see my attacker the first time. I want to tell him it's the same guy, so they'll know the crimes are connected. But what if he's testing me? Seeing whether I'll change my story about not seeing my initial assailant? I answer slowly.
If I saw the person the first time, I do not recall it.
He leans forward. Could it be the same man?
I would not rule out the possibility, sir. I was attacked in an alley and strangled. This man attempted to do the same with a rope. If it was the same killer, he may have realized that was more effective than manual strangulation.
He thumps back in his seat and into his thoughts. At least 2 minutes pass before he says, as abruptly as if we'd never stopped talking, "Describe the recent attacker."
He was dressed entirely in black, including a mask of some sort.
Like a theater mask? I shake my head.
It was black fabric with holes for eyes and presumably for his mouth, though the lane was too dark for me to make that out. Also too dark for me to see eye color. He wore a black mask, a coat like a cape, a black shirt and trousers, male, between 5'8" and 5'9", 11 or 12 stone.
That is very specific.
Damn. Less cop, more housemaid. I take a deep breath before plowing on with,
I am certain it is the man you seek. The Raven Killer.
I expect him to grumble at that, to pull back and even dismiss the rest of my description, clearly influenced by my presumption. I won't retract that, though. I would rather damage my reputation with Gray than damage the investigation. He does not pull back, does not dismiss me, just grunts, and then the carriage stops and he ushers me out. A few words to Simon, and the coach leaves us on the roadside. I look around. It's a busy street, with the castle rising over the craggy hill in the background. To my left, I see a sign that makes me do a double take, seeing my own surname. It's for a James Atkinson, joiner, advertising his services in both cabinet making and undertaking. The rough stone building seems half collapsed, with a newer roof patched on. Advertising flyers cover one wall. I'm still gazing at my surroundings when I realize I've lost my boss. He's moving fast along the narrow road, and I scamper to catch up. I've just reached him when he speaks as if never noticing I'd disappeared.
Describe the feather.
The
peacock feather, he says impatiently.
Right. It looked like...
I stop myself before saying it looked like a peacock feather.
It was cut short, to fit inside his jacket, I presume. Less than a foot of quill. It was mostly the eye, and it was kind of ragged, but the colors were really bright.
Describe.
The colors?
I pull up an image from my mind.
Green and blue with an orange eye. It looked unnaturally colorful, garish.
Peacock feathers usually are.
Yes, but this was unusually so. It may have been dyed.
And what happened to it?
Gray turns a corner before I can answer, and I kick up my pace to reach him.
The feather fell out as we fought, I say. Afterward, he stayed in the shadows. The men never even realized he was wearing a mask. Their attention was on me. He reached down, and I thought he was picking up my knife, so I shouted a warning. But one of my so-called rescuers had my knife, and when my attacker left, the feather was gone.
He grunts. I take a deep breath.
There was also a piece of paper with my name on it.
He wheels so fast I fall back before steadying myself.
I decided not to mention it because you obviously did not believe me about the feather.
I tell him how I was lured in and how I found my name on that paper, presumably to startle me, while he attacked. I believe, I say, that I was made a target because I am your housemate, possibly even your temporary assistant. If the killer is following the investigation, he may have known I assisted Detective MacCready at the rooming house. It seems a departure from the first murder, though, and I am not certain what to make of it. I pause. Unless he planned to torture me for information on the investigation, strangle me to unconsciousness, take me somewhere and torture me. Gray only nods abruptly. Then he continues walking. We turn another corner. It's a quieter area, residential, with buildings that would have been upper-middle-class townhouses at one time, converted to overflowing tenements when the wealthier residents fled across the old medieval wall to the new town. Voices sound ahead. A whistle blows, someone shouts, and a male voice barks a command. Before I can ask where we're going, again, we round yet another corner of these maze-like streets, and I see the crowd ahead. The narrow road has been blocked off. A constable, with a whistle, warning carts to turn back. It's a wasted effort. The crowd is so thick that no cart could pass, and the constable is left arguing with cart drivers who have no intention of turning back. They want to see what's going on, only adding to the tumult. Gray strides forward. He reaches back to take my elbow and seems surprised that I'm right beside him, shouldering men out of my way. He still grasps my elbow so we don't become separated by the crowd. It's at least 20 men deep. Oh, there are a few women, but most of them have been relegated to the edges, the men forgetting their chivalry when they want to see what's going on themselves. I'm soon glad of Gray's guiding grip. He's tall enough that his head clears the crowd, and he has no compunction about using his size to barrel through. He carries himself like a man of his class, expecting to be obeyed. It works far better than my pokes and squeezes and elbows. And soon we are through, leaving a trail of muttered epithets in our way. When we reach the edge, a constable tries to stop us. "He's with me," a voice calls. I recognize it as MacCready, though I still can't see him. Even this inner circle is a mob of police officers and witnesses and others who seem to have just broken through to the middle. The class or status of the trespassers means the constables don't dare expel them. Dear God, don't tell me this is a crime scene. My left eyelid starts twitching as I watch people tramping about. It takes all my strength not to order them aside myself. Has no one heard of crime scene containment? No, Mallory, they have not, because they've barely begun using police to solve crimes. Proper protocol is decades away, after they discover the importance of fingerprints and other evidence. The constable lets us through. As he does, another leans in to whisper something. I catch the words, "That gray ghoul." The first officer mutters, "He doesn't look gray to me," and they both chuckle. "Enough of that," a young voice says. I glance over to see Constable Findlay glowering at the two older officers. Gray waves for him to ignore the insult, and Findlay nods and then leads us to the center, where I stop short, blinking. There is a woman lying dead beside the steps of a house, with a gate behind her, presumably leading to a yard beyond. That is not what makes me blink. Nor does the fact that she's just lying there, people milling about, some leaning in for a better look as if she's a display in a wax museum. A display in a wax museum. A chill runs through me because it is exactly the right description. That is why I stop short. I have seen this tableau before, and it takes only a moment to identify the source. yet another of those macabre museum exhibits Nan had taken me to. I can't quite recall whether this was a special exhibition in a proper museum, or more a tourist wax museum. I remember this scene, though. A woman lying at the gate leading to a stable. A row of what looked like once decent residential townhouses, now decayed into tenement housing. The museum exhibit said she'd been there all night, with people later admitting they'd passed and presumed she was drunk or sleeping rough. It was that sort of neighborhood, after all. The street was called Buck's Row, somehow shortened from Ducking Pond Row, because there was a nearby pond used for ducking punishments. That is the detail from the exhibit that pops out now, one my young brain had tucked away because I wanted to know what a ducking punishment was. Finally, someone had investigated. They discovered a dead woman, still warm, lying on her back. Her throat had been slashed. Later, a medical examiner would discover more. Bruises on her face, as if she'd been struck. Stab wounds to her groin and abdomen. No organs missing. That would come later, with other victims. This is what I see here, in 1869 Edinburgh. It's one of those memories seemingly long vanished, shooting forth in perfect detail, like a stored snapshot awaiting a trigger. I have seen this before. Everything is perfectly reproduced. From the victim, a graying brunette in her early 40s, to the petticoats in disarray around her. There is a split second where I think what I saw in the 21st century was a recreation of this very murder. No. This isn't the same murder. It just looks like it. Rendered in as much detail as the killer could manage. Recreating a murder that will not occur for another 20 years. That museum exhibit had been on Jack the Ripper. The woman lying dead in Buck's Row. The first of the canonical 5 victims. Chapter 27. Polly Nichols. That's the name that comes to mind, and I wouldn't bet my life savings on it, but I'd shout it out at a trivia night. I'd gone on a Ripper kick in high school. It was right around the time I was solidifying my plan to become a detective, making sure it was more than a childhood dream. Jack the Ripper is the most famous unsolved case in history. So I threw myself into it as a would-be detective. What I eventually realized is that it was a fun little exercise, but ultimately a futile pursuit. It had been so early in the history of forensics and detective work that one could only blindly speculate on the killer, based on one's favored theory. Before me lies an exact replica of Polly Nichols' murder. 20 years before Polly Nichols will die. Here is the final proof I need. Proof that the guy who tried to kill me 2 nights ago is from the 21st century. He decided to copycat the most famous serial killer of all time. You bastard. The curse rings in my head as Gray leads me to the body. I don't spend one moment wondering why the killer did this. I know why. I remember being in Gray's room, going through those newspapers and pamphlets, expecting so much more coverage. The killer expected it too. No one had cared. Not really. A journalist strangled and staged to look like a bird? Next, please. So he decided to do next. The next level. You want more? How about a pretty housemaid slaughtered in an alley? But I thwarted him, and this is my reward. Oh, it might have nothing to do with me, but I still feel responsible. The killer planned to take a young and pretty victim in hopes that would give him the attention he wanted. Better yet, I was connected to the detective on his trail, and he does love his connections, as if we deserved our fate by offending him. I did more than offend him. I survived his attack, twice, and so he has rethought his plan and decided to make a full right turn. Because he can. He isn't driven by any compulsion to murder in a specific way. He's flexible. And here, he's flexed to something far cleverer than staging his victims as birds. He's stealing from the future. Stealing the thunder of the most famous serial killer of all time. It is breathtakingly clever. And I do not grant him one iota of credit for it, because seeing this poor woman, all I can do is inwardly rage at the pointlessness of her murder, chosen only because she bears a superficial resemblance to Polly Nichols. What will happen in Jack the Ripper's time now? Will he still kill Polly Nichols in the same manner? He might, if news of this killing never reaches London. But if he does, it will not take long before someone sees the connection and paints history's most infamous serial killer as a mere copycat. This killer will be the original. As I step toward the body, I stop, feeling eyes on me. I look up to see the shocked faces of those nearby as a woman, a housemaid, still in uniform, approaches the body. I ignore those looks and scan the crowd. In public murders, especially serial killings, it's basic protocol to get a look at the crowd. My fingers itch to take cell phone photos, in case the killer is there, gloating and vibrating in excitement at seeing his handiwork admired. Here, with all these people, it would be easy to get close. And I can do no more than survey faces. Are you here? I sliced my attacker's arm and stabbed his side. That would be far more helpful in identifying him if people in this world wore less clothing. Even with the sun promising a warm day, all the men are in long sleeves. Most also in jackets. Next time, I'll need to aim for the face. Even if the killer isn't here, I'm sure my own presence will not go unremarked. Newspapers will mention the fair-haired maid who accompanied the notorious Dr. Gray. If the killer didn't realize I was involved in the case before, he'll know now. Good. Yes, that puts me in danger. But I was already there. And if he targets me again, I will be ready. I will catch him if I can, and I will see his face if I cannot. One last slow look at the crowd. Then I bend beside the body. I forget I'm Katrina Mitchell. I've become Detective Mallory Atkinson, attending a crime scene, and I kneel a foot from her head. When someone shouts a horrified warning, I startle, realizing what I'm doing. Before I can scramble back, Gray's hand lands on my shoulder, staying me. "Don't let the lass see this," a voice says. And I look to see MacReady bearing down on us. The poor woman has been savaged. And Katrina could see that before she wished a closer examination, Gray says placidly. She has a keen eye and an iron stomach. If she wishes to look, let her. MacReady grumbles, but he doesn't tell me to get back. His concern was entirely for my feminine sensibilities. The thought that a layperson, a housemaid, shouldn't get this close to a murder victim doesn't seem to occur to him. Doesn't seem to occur to anyone from the looks of things. "How long do I have?" Gray asks MacReady. "A runner went to fetch Addington shortly after I sent for you," MacReady says, his voice low. "I held off as long as I could. I know you like to see victims on the scene when possible, and in this case..." He spares a glance for the dead woman. "It seemed wise to do so. Also, there is the feather." His gaze travels to the left, and I follow it to see a feather wedged under her shoulder. A peacock feather. "The same?" Gray murmurs to me. I start moving aside for a better look at the feather. His hand falls on mine, the warmth of it startling me. He pulls back quickly with a murmured apology and then says, "We have limited time. The feather can be examined later."
"It appears to be the same," I say.
MacReady says, "I apologize for doubting you." I would have doubted me too, under the circumstances. I turn to the body. MacReady squats beside us to listen in.
"I'm afraid I do not have time to make this a teaching exercise," Gray says as he takes a probe from his pocket. "Nor even a lecture. I will discuss my findings later. However, please draw your own conclusions, both of you, and feel free to voice them aloud."
He holds out the probe. I take it, automatically. Then I pause and hold it out to MacReady. The detective shakes his head.
"I will observe, only. My stomach is not as strong as yours."
I wait to see where Gray will start. He is the doctor, after all. He begins at the neck and uses forceps to examine it quickly before moving down to her abdomen. I take over examining the neck injuries. Her throat hasn't just been slashed. It's been cut right to the vertebrae. That's the most obvious thing, and I need to see past the horror of it to examine further. After a moment, I murmur, "Hesitation marks." I don't mean to speak aloud, and Gray startles as if I shouted. He twists to look at the victim's neck.
"What was that, Katrina?"
I pause a moment, then plow forward. "These marks here, sir." I point to them. "They seem to indicate that the killer hesitated. That is to say, he did not make the cuts decisively."
"Took him some nerve to work up to it," MacReady says.
"Perhaps," Gray says.
"I had noted the marks. I was not certain what they indicated, but hesitation seems a good interpretation. Thank you, Katrina."
He taps the forceps on a spot below the victim's ear.
"Did you note these abrasions?"
"I had not. They would suggest strangulation, I believe. Strangled and then her throat cut."
I reached to check under her eyelids before stopping myself.
"What were you about to do, Katrina?"
I think that book mentioned something about seeing signs of strangulation in the whites of the eyes."
A hint of a smile as he nods. He uses his forceps to nudge up the victim's lids, and I see the red of hemorrhaging.
"Now, I promised I was not going to teach, and here I am teaching. Continue to make observations, Katrina, aloud, please, as I examine the abdominal injuries."
"I do not wish to disturb you, sir."
"If you mean that in truth, then let me assure you, I am capable of listening while also focusing on my work. However, if you feel I am pressuring you, you may refrain from voicing your observations."
I glance at MacReady, who offers me a small smile and mouths,
"Go on."
"She wasn't killed here," I say,
which is a bit of a cheat because there's no way in hell the killer happened to find just the right victim at just the right spot to stage his reenactment.
"There's not enough blood on the ground for that. I've seen animals slaughtered, and so I know the signs."
"You do not need to explain how your knowledge arises, Katrina. I trust it is not from personal experience with murder."
"Only the personal experience of having nearly been a victim of it twice."
I get a brief smile from both men for that. I push on.
"You'll want to find the actual site of the murder, won't you? It'll have a lot of blood."
I pause.
"Unless the blood settled after the strangulation, can you tell how much time passed between that and the throat being cut?"
"I may be able to attempt it, if I am allowed to take possession of the body after the autopsy." And if Addington doesn't butcher her more with the autopsy, MacReady mutters. Examine the edges of the wound and you'll see they're quite bloodless, Gray says, still working on the abdomen. My preliminary assessment would be that she was killed elsewhere by strangulation and then brought here, where the knife work was done. The blood, as you noted correctly, would have settled by that time, causing a lack of it here at the scene. Hugh, can you show Katrina how to check for that? MacReady pulls down the shoulder of the victim's dress, as circumspectly as possible, and points out the lividity, indicating the blood has settled. We can even tell how she was lying post-death by the pattern, Gray continues. For that, we'll need to disrobe her, though, which we obviously will not do here. Now, come look at... Sir? It's Findlay, hurrying over to MacReady. I spotted the doctor's coach around the corner. Good lad, MacReady says. You have keen eyes. Findlay glances down and bobs his head. Then he sneaks a look at me as we move away from the body. It doesn't bother you, Miss Katrina? He asks. Looking at that? It doesn't if I remind myself the examination is necessary to find her killer, I say. I suppose so. He glances back at the corpse and swallows. I have never seen one so brutalized. This is an extreme case, MacReady says. There is no shame in finding it difficult to look upon her. Try not to think of the body as a person, I say. You'll need to when you investigate her death, but for now, put that aside if you can. Findlay peers at me intently, obviously not expecting these words from Katrina, and I'm wondering whether I went too far when Gray says, Katrina is very astute. The object behind us is a piece of evidence. The person within is gone. You honor that person by solving her murder, and you needn't worry about causing insult by examining her remains. Gray and MacReady move away to speak, leaving me with Findlay. I heard about your attack on Wednesday night, he says. I know Detective MacReady doubted you at first, but he said the feather proves it. I wanted to say that I am sorry, and I hope you are all right. I am. Thank you. I look at the crowd, and then back at him. I am sorry for how I treated you. You're a good police officer. He goes still, and I realize he might think I'm mocking him. I grimace. That sounded patronizing. I apologize. I mean it honestly. You were a good officer, and I endangered that, and I'm sorry. If anything ever comes of what I did, I will take the blame. I'll tell Detective MacReady I stole your notes, and that's how I came by the information. His gaze moves away as he says, gruffly, It was my mistake. No, I will fix it if need be. I mean that. And I am not saying so in hopes of renewing our attachment. Dear God, no. I am only trying to make amends. I scan the crowd again. If I may pass on a bit of advice, take note of faces in the crowd. The killer could be here. He considers that, again watching me intently. You have a gift for this. Perhaps more than I. Is that jealousy? It doesn't sound like it, just an observation. I shrug. I have traveled in the circles of criminals. I know their minds. It's just another way to do detective work. It seems to me that the killer wishes to call attention to himself, first with a bizarre murder and now a horrific one. If that is the case, might he not be here to see his handiwork admired? When he doesn't answer, I say,
It was only a suggestion. After all, I am but a housemaid.
MacReady walks over with Gray. I thought of taking note of the crowd, Findlay says to MacReady. Being such a gruesome murder, is it possible the killer might be here, watching our horror?
MacReady smiles.
That is a capital idea, Colin. Yes, please do that.
Findlay nods his thanks to me and moves into the crowd. A coach, drawn by two horses, clatters down the lane, and as we look up, MacReady grumbles.
Trust Addington to insist on bringing his coach where it obviously cannot fit.
It does fit, but only by driving all the foot traffic into side streets and alleyways, the displaced shaking their fists at the passing driver.
Even if his driver can get in, I say, how is he going to get out again?
Easy, MacReady says. Addington will expect us to move the body and clear away the crime scene so that he may continue down the lane.
I try not to blink in horror. A crime scene is about to be destroyed so the coroner can visit in his personal coach. As I stare, a prickle on the back of my neck has me scanning the crowd. I meet eyes. Male eyes. Many, angry, as if affronted at my presence here, front and center. That would include most of the other officers, unfortunately. Get used to it, boys. The women at your crime scenes won't always be lying on the ground with their throats slit. The driver gets as far as he can, then hops down to open the door as if for royalty. I'm surprised the poor guy isn't expected to bow. A man climbs out of the coach. The doctor's assistant, or intern. He's in his late 20s, lanky and red-haired. He pulls out his boss's black medical bag. Then he shuts the door and strides toward us.
MacReady! He calls in a voice far too deep and hearty for his youth. Dr. Addington.
I squint against the sun, thinking I must be wrong about his age. But my first impression doesn't change as he grows closer. He's ruddy-cheeked, with an unlined face that says he probably hasn't passed his 30th birthday.
Gray, he calls. Whatever are you doing here?
There's no malice in his tone, no sarcasm either. His voice warms with the genuine affection of a man greeting an esteemed colleague.
I heard of the death and thought it a rare opportunity to observe a murder victim in situ. Excellent idea.
He claps Gray on the arm, and here a touch of condescension tinges Addington's voice.
Now my question, MacReady, is why someone didn't come to tell me Dr. Gray was on the scene, so I didn't need to come.
As you are the city's police surgeon, sir, I am required to summon you. Also, I thought, like Duncan, you might wish to see the body, as he says, in situ.
Whatever for?
Addington peers over at the woman's body.
If you would like my opinion, detective, the poor lady is quite dead.
He laughs at his own joke.
Dr. Gray may never have practiced medicine, but even he can tell you that.
Gray stiffens. And there it is, the reason for Addington's mild condescension. He is a proper doctor, and Gray is not.
You still ought to have sent someone to tell me Dr. Gray is here,
Addington chides MacReady.
I was in the midst of seeing a patient when your messenger arrived. How much more convenient for me to finish that up and have a cup of tea before strolling down to Dr. Gray's house to conduct the examination.
Your convenience is my utmost concern, Dr. Addington, MacReady says. Addington slaps him on the arm.
There's a good chap. Now, let's see if you can clear this mess away so my coach may pass through. And with any luck, I can flee this wretched place before the stench ruins this suit forever.
He turns to Gray.
Would you be a good chap and deliver her to your examination room?
Is that where you want her? MacReady says.
At Dr. Gray's and not in the police office dead room.
Addington shivers.
Why ever would I wish to examine her there? Dr. Gray's offices are so much better supplied and so much more convivial. We have this arrangement for a reason, MacReady.
I am only making certain, MacReady murmurs, so I might convey your decision to my superiors, who are of the opinion that this case may be different.
How? She's dead. Murdered. Nothing different in that. I shall await her at Dr. Gray's offices.
So this is how Gray gets away with examining bodies. They have an arrangement with Addington, who lives in the new town and wants the prestige of being the police surgeon, but not the inconvenience of carrying out autopsies in an actual police station. Cleverly done.
Dr. Addington, Gray says as the other man begins returning to his coach. Might I beg your indulgence in allowing me to examine the body at the scene? For my studies.
Of course, of course. She's not going anywhere, is she? Just move her out of the way so my coach can pass.
Gray opens his mouth to argue, but Addington ploughs on.
Then I'll nip by your house in, say, an hour? Oh, and as I have missed my morning tea, could you please have your housekeeper fix me a tray? And if you could have that delightful little maid of yours bring it by, I would be most obliged.
He winks at Gray.
I haven't seen her in a while, and I miss the sight of that delectable girl.
He strides away, whistling, without waiting for a response.
Please tell me he wasn't talking about Alice, I say.
MacReady snorts a laugh.
No, thankfully. He meant you.
He failed to see me standing right here.
Dr. Addington fails to see anything he doesn't want to see, including, half the time, the proper cause of death.
MacReady slants a glance at me.
Before you ask, he has not been in his position long. The former police surgeon was an excellent fellow, very deserving of the office. But he retired, and Dr. Addington has connections that saw him elected despite his incompetence. However, it does allow us to take advantage.
I turn to Gray, but he's already at the body, where she's been moved to let Addington pass. MacReady winks. Time for our not a lesson to resume.
Chapter 28. And so I am back in Gray's good graces. He doesn't say so, doesn't join MacReady in apologizing for questioning my attack story either. His apology comes in action, and from the moment he heard about the feather, the mistrust began to ebb, and I am once again his assistant. He examines the body while taking time now to explain what he's doing, and also keeping an eye on his pocket watch. At the last possible moment, the victim is loaded onto a cart. And that's when the victim's sister shows up. The timing was not accidental. While MacReady seemed to be completely focused on Gray's examination, he was multitasking, having already gotten a preliminary ID on the body and sent officers to track down next of kin. They found the sister and brought her to the scene. And I will say little about that, except that I truly hope the killer is not in the crowd to feed off her grief. Obviously, I'm horrified at the thought of bringing next of kin to the actual crime scene, but MacReady is following procedure, where efficiency is the key. Get the body identified as quickly as possible. To his credit, when he realizes the sister has arrived, he hurries to the cart and covers the body himself, exposing only her face. I cringe at possible trace contamination from the blanket, but his heart is in the right place, and trace transfer is hardly a concern in a world that doesn't test for trace yet. As for me, I help in the only way I can, by staying far from the cart and leaving the poor woman to her grief. I'm bent examining the peacock feather when Gray strides over to scoop it up, making me wince. Again, I remind myself that without fingerprint or DNA testing, there's no concern with handling evidence, but I still inwardly squirm.
It is the same, yes?
If not the exact one, then it's an exact match, I say. There's something on the bottom of the quill, where it's been cut off. Hacked off, it looks like. A black staining, like ink.
Because it is ink, he says.
Ah, right. Hard to find peacock feathers just lying about, so he made do with a peacock feather pen. Would the dyeing make it cheap or expensive?
Cheap, he says. A substandard feather, dyed.
Also ragged, I say. Probably not a new pen, then. Where would one purchase a used peacock quill pen?
His lips twitch. Now you wish to take poor Findlay's job, too. Shall I lose you to Hugh?
I was speculating, I say. But if you are not interested in theorizing...
An unmistakable glitter lights his eyes. I am far too interested in theorizing, as Hugh would tell you. Not that he complains about me playing detective. He's happy enough for my deductions, though it doesn't keep him from grumbling about them.
Tell him you are a consulting detective.
One brow arches.
Sherlock Holmes? I say.
His expression tells me that, once again, I am ahead of my time. Or behind it. I've lost track.
Hugh? Gray calls, waving the feather as MacReady returns from the cart. May we take this for examination?
I open my mouth to protest, but MacReady shrugs.
If you like.
Gray pockets the evidence as I suppress a whimper.
There's also a raven feather, MacReady says. It was under her body. Would you like that too?
Please. Gray turns to me.
Shall we wash up before we return home?
Yes, sir, if we may.
Let's do that then, and we'll find ourselves a cab. Hugh, will you join us for lunch? I will not turn down Mrs. Wallace's cooking.
We're having lunch while Addington conducts the autopsy with his assistant, who turns out to be an old guy, looking a lot like I'd expected of Addington himself. I delivered their tray and endured Addington's ogling, and then I hurried back to serve lunch. We are settling into a midday repast of hot soup and cold roast goose when Isla returns.
I am in time for lunch, she declares, walking in. Hugh, how lovely to see you.
MacReady clambers to his feet to take her coat and pull out her chair. Then, just as she's about to slide in front of it, he slams it in again.
No, he says. You cannot join us, Isla.
If this is a game, Hugh, I am much too hungry to play it.
She takes hold of the chair, but he grips it in place.
We are discussing a murder, MacReady says.
Her gaze slides to me before darting away.
I see. Well, I am glad that Katrina is assisting you again, Duncan. But there is nothing about the murder of Archie Evans that I do not know from the papers. And it was a decidedly bloodless affair.
There's been a second murder. It is different.
Different how?
MacReady pauses and then blurts.
Bloodier.
How bloody?
She waves off her own question.
Never mind. I am determined to join this meal and this conversation. Whatever happened to the poor man?
Woman, MacReady says.
Possibly a prostitute?
She frowns.
Was there an outrage committed against her?
No, nothing like that. At least...
He glances at Gray, who shakes his head.
No outrage, but a gruesome murder. It was very brutal, and you will not wish to discuss it while eating.
Is that not for me to determine? I am quite capable of leaving if I feel overwhelmed.
You may be physically able to leave, but
You are too bloody stubborn.
Her throat was cut, I say, deeply. Her abdomen stabbed and her, nether regions also stabbed.
Katrina!
MacReady wheels on me. I placidly spoon up my cream soup.
I believe Mrs. Ballantyne is a grown woman who ought not to be treated as a child. If she wishes to endure a conversation that may cause nightmares, that is her choice, is it not? She knows the gist of it now. She can make her own decision.
Thank you, Katrina, Isla says. And she pulls sharply on her chair, wrenching it from MacReady.
The detective looks to Gray for help, but Gray only shrugs as he slices into his goose.
The girl has a point. Isla now knows what happened to the woman, and the choice is hers. I would strongly suggest,
he slants a look at his sister, that she not view the body. But otherwise, I accept her choice.
Good, Isla says as she sits. Now, tell me about this poor woman.
The victim, as her sister confirmed for MacReady, is one Rose Wright, widowed and living with her sister, the one who'd come to identify the body.
Is she a sex worker?
I ask when MacReady finishes explaining. MacReady chokes on a bite of goose. Isla clears her throat, obviously trying hard to keep from laughing.
I know your vocabulary has been disturbed, Katrina, but we do not generally use that word in company, polite or otherwise.
Worker? I say, catching her eye with a look that makes her lose control of that laugh. Gray only shakes his head, a smile playing on his lips.
Fine, I say. Is she a prostitute?
There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that word. As a police officer, I'd been trained to use sex worker instead, to avoid the stigma that is associated with prostitute. The exact same stigma, I realize, that is attached to sex in this time period. Of course, judging by what I read of Lady Inglis's letter, Victorians are having and enjoying sex. They just don't talk about it. How terribly Victorian of them. I press on.
The fact that Rose has taken money for her time doesn't mean that it's her primary occupation. When I was on the streets, I knew women who'd sell their favor if they really needed the money. They had jobs, but those jobs didn't always pay the bills.
Katrina is correct, Isla says. While this woman may have engaged in prostitution, do not presume that makes her a prostitute. And even if it does, please do not treat her any less for it.
I would not do that, Isla, MacReady says. And there's a gentleness in his voice. Their eyes meet as she nods in acknowledgement.
I cannot answer the question either way yet, MacReady continues. I was not about to interview her poor sister over the body. That will be my first stop this afternoon, interviewing the family.
Might I come along? I ask.
To the interview, he says. I hesitate. I'd asked without thinking. Well, yes, I'd been thinking, but only that I wanted to speak to her family and friends. I have information MacReady does not. I know now, beyond a doubt, that this is a killer from my own time. I know he's copying Jack the Ripper. I know there may be a connection between the killer and Rose Wright, if he's following his pattern of needing a personal connection. The problem, of course, is that there is absolutely no reason for Katrina to be at those interviews.
I thought I might be able to help. Perhaps I could go along as your secretary?
A female secretary?
It is the 19th century, Hugh, Isla says tartly. Women may be barred from many occupations, but they are perfectly capable of being whatever they want, including secretaries.
I am not arguing that, MacReady says, but I thought Katrina would be needed to help Duncan with his examination of the body.
Gray takes a bite of cheese, his face studiously neutral.
If Katrina would prefer to help you, and you have need of her, then I understand. My work is not as interesting as yours.
Here stands the proverbial crossroads. I can stay behind and work with Gray, or I can convince MacReady to take me along to witness, and maybe help with, the interview. I do want to help examine Rose's body. I just want to postpone it until after the interview. That is impossible. Pick one, Mallory. There's no real question. Long term, I want to help Gray. And so I murmur,
I was not thinking about the body, sir. I would prefer to stay, if it is all right with you.
Isla gives a slight nod of approval. Then she says,
How about we discuss the interview? While I know Hugh is quite capable of handling it on his own, we may be able to come up with interrogative directions he has not considered.
Certainly, MacReady says. I'm always happy to accept assistance. After all, he winks at Isla, I'm the one making the salary and the one who'll reap the benefits. Unpaid help is always welcome.
Oh, you will pay for it, Isla says. I have a short list of dangerous chemicals I cannot obtain on my own. A police officer, however, would have no such difficulty requisitioning them from the chemist.
MacReady smiles. Consider it done.
After lunch, MacReady conducts an interview. Not the one with the victim's family. The one with the killer's former victim. Me. One would think this might have taken precedence over lunch. One would also think that, having been nearly murdered by a serial killer and escaping through my wits and fists, I'd get a little more, oh, I don't know, sympathy? Hey, Katrina, seems you really were nearly murdered by the guy we've been looking for. Why don't you take the day off dusting? Relax, put your feet up. Anything we can get you? A cold drink, perhaps? A plate of biscuits? We settle into the drawing room, and MacReady says, So, it seems Katrina escaped our raven killer after all.
What?
Isla says, in the midst of lowering herself onto a chair. Naturally, just because I'm about to be interviewed by the police doesn't mean I need privacy or anything. I don't actually care, but yes, it's a little odd to retire to the drawing room, as if we're about to sip a fine glass of port, maybe play a little charades. And instead, I say to Isla,
There was a peacock feather found with the body, which matches the one my attacker dropped. Dr. Gray asked me to describe it before we arrived on the scene, to be sure my recollection wasn't tainted by seeing it again.
I don't blame Gray for that. Standard practice, even if he wouldn't realize it.
That was a good idea, Duncan, MacReady says. I'd make a good...
Gray glances at me.
Consulting detective.
MacReady laughs.
As long as you don't expect a cut of my pay, you can call yourself whatever you like.
Yes, it appears to be the same killer. I would say it is, but we must always leave room for doubt when any exists. He glances at me.
No insult to Katrina.
None taken. I am satisfied as long as no one continues to doubt that I was attacked by what seemed to be the Raven Killer.
There is no doubt of that, MacReady says. I apologize again for the earlier confusion. Now, would you take me through the events of that evening?
I glance at Isla.
I think I should be honest here as to what I was doing out that evening. If I may.
Isla hesitates. It won't do me any favors to admit I'd stolen her locket. Any lie, though, taints my testimony.
Isla nods. You may. I would like to say first that the matter has been resolved, and I am fully persuaded of Katrina's commitment to this second chance life has given her. I do not hold this or any prior action against her.
Well, now I really do want to know what you were doing out there, MacReady says.
I explain. As I do, both men's moods shift. Sparks of outrage from MacReady and a descending thundercloud of anger from Gray.
Your locket, MacReady says. She stole your grandmother's locket.
Isla raises her hands.